Blog Talk Radio.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
I'm Scott Nickrens, music director at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, and you're listening to The Concert from GardnerMuseum.org. Join me in the museum's tapestry room as we listen to some outstanding live performances you won't hear anywhere else.
This week, for our 16th episode of The Concert, we'll be listening to two pieces for two very different solo instruments, piano and cello. First on the program, cellist Colin Carr will play Bach's fifth cello suite. This is one of six solo suites Bach wrote for the cello. In these pieces, made up of solo melodic lines, harmony still plays a big role. In fact, while you're listening, you may notice your ear filling in notes that aren't actually played, like connecting the dots on a page. In this suite, Bach gives the listener just enough dots to evoke those harmonies while still retaining a melancholy sparseness in the music. It's also interesting to realize that each of the movements of the suite is based on a different style of dance. While Bach probably didn't intend for people to dance to the cello suites, the forms he uses come from this tradition. After the delicacy of the Bach cello suites, the opening of Schubert's A minor piano sonata seems downright bombastic. The first movement shuttles back and forth between declarative chords, like the opening, and longer poetic lines, a familiar hallmark of Schubert's style. This performance is played by pianist Seymour Lipkin. Before we get to the rousing finale, let's listen to the solo cello played by Colin Carr.
Thank you.
the context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade. I want to thank everybody for hanging in. Broadcast was held up a little bit, of course, in the system of white supremacy. Have difficulties, just have to work through. Want to check to see if Mr. Bradley is on the line for us. 804, is this Mr. Bradley?
No, it's not.
Okie dokie, thank you so much. Hold on 1 second. Groovy. We are working to get Mr. Bradley on the line with us now so we can kick off with the broadcast. Again, I want to thank everybody for hanging in, technical difficulties, but doing what we can as non-whites, victims of white supremacy, to replace the system of white supremacy with justice. Definitely looking forward to Mr. Bradley calling in so we can talk about his book, The Iceman Inheritance, and his views on what can be done to replace the system of racism, white supremacy, with a system of justice. Hopefully he'll be coming through in the next couple minutes so we can get rolling. Other than that, I want to thank everybody who's been hanging in the chat room. They have been very patient. I haven't heard one insult, one ugly word, son of man, Bandung too. He's been here for 2 weeks, and he didn't even get to get on the last call last week. Conscious Vibrations, Born Before Time, a lot of guests, I don't know if they are, but thank them for hanging out as well. RNL, excuse me, lost one of my names here. RNLA76. Yeah, just thanks everybody for hanging out in the chat room, being patient. No gripes, no complaints. That's very interesting. Have a non-white person who is asking me get through with the show, and apparently Mr. Bradley's line is busy. I don't know what that means. Perhaps he's talking to someone else. Perhaps he's practicing racism. Don't know. Hopefully he'll give us a jingle here soon. Actually, what I will do in the meantime, since Mr. Bandung is here, we will have our international counter-racism experience regardless. Bandung, too, are you there? You're on the line? Bandung, too, your mic is unmuted. Are you there, sir? Very interesting. I don't hear anything. If he's there, Mike is not on mute. Okie dokie. Not hearing him. I'll leave his mic unmuted. Bandung, if you do get this, your mic is unmuted. So if you do catch on at some point, feel free to chat. Let us know you're here. Yeah, definitely. I wanted to speak with you last week when we had Dr. Kevorkian present to have you share your views, because it was your blog that tipped me to Mr. Kevorkian being out there in the first place. I didn't know anything about his book, Color Monitors, or what he talks about at all. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Yes. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Fantastic.
I can hear you. I can hear you.
Great. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you. Can you please tell everyone your name and tell them about your blog, sir?
Sure. My name is Dr. Sayyid Mustafa Ali, and I'm a member of Bandung 2, which is a group of individuals committed to replacing race supremacy with justice. I'm affiliated with the Bandung 2 movement. The web movement is chat room, and it's also www.bandung2.com. bandong2blog.co.uk, the Bandung 2 blog, which you can access at http://bandung2.co.uk.
Groovy, groovy. I was telling our listeners that I found your blog and linked it on my page, and just paying attention to your blog, that's how I became aware of Martin Kevorkian's work, Color Monitors. You had written at least two posts about it before the show last week. Actually, hold on one sec. I want to check to see if we have Mr. Bradley. Are you going to stay with us, Bandung 2? Dr. Ali?
Sure.
Groovy. Certainly. Hang on. I will see if Mr. Bradley is with us. 646, is this Mr. Bradley?
It is.
Outstanding.
I was told to phone you at 4.
Yes, sir.
And I did.
you are with us. Everything is great. Difficulties as usual in the system of racism, white supremacy, but worked everything out lovely. Again, this is the Cows Context of White Supremacy with Gus P. Renegade and our special guest, Mr. Michael Bradley. Mr. Bradley, could you please tell our listeners any information about yourself that you think is constructive?
Well, I'm author of The Iceman Inheritance, which was published in 1978, and it sort of advocated the idea that because of anthropological reasons, the white race, or what's called Caucasians, although that's not well defined, were more aggressive than other groups of people due to basically psychosexual aggression and ambivalence and confusion. That's what I wrote in 78. And I did a revised version in 2003, I believe. But at about that same time, there were some other new discoveries which had not been made in 78 and were just made in 2002. And by the time I filled myself in on those new discoveries in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, I then got a better handle on what the anthropological reasons for this aggression. And it's not different from Iceman, but it sort of refines it a bit and also gives it a bit more depth, because now there's more hard evidence. So
okay.
That's it.
Okie dokie. I read your book and thoroughly enjoyed your work in The Iceman Inheritance, as well as the article that you mailed me from your website. What I want to do is really make an effort to share constructive information with our listeners who may not have read your work or your article. I'd like to do is make a request if you could make an effort to make your responses as easy to grasp as possible for our listeners who might not be familiar with your work and who might not have really the criterion I try to use is that if a 13-year-old was listening to this broadcast, they would be able to grasp exactly what it is that you're talking about and wouldn't be confused. So if you could, I don't want to say dumb it down, but that's really the core of what I'm saying. If you could make it as easy to grasp what it is that you're saying as possible, because I think
I'm afraid that your listeners are going to have to take what I say, whether it's dumbed down or not, because I don't want to be dumbed down. I don't want to be misquoted, and I will say what I have to say. If they can understand it, fine. If they cannot, that's fine too.
Okay. Well, if understanding is very important, so if
it is, but But I'll tell you, some things are simply not simple.
Oh, for sure.
And this is one situation in which things are simply not simple.
Okay. What I will do then to work to compensate.
You can translate.
Yes, sir. I will make an effort to restate anything that you say that I think I want to make sure that they grasp. I'll restate it, and you can tell me whether or not I have accurately restated.
Sure.
Okay. That'll work. Number one, are you a white person?
I am.
Okay. Number two, this program, the cows, context of white supremacy. I define, and this is something I really appreciated about your work. You repeatedly called attention to the importance of words and definitions. So what I want to do is define what I mean when I say white supremacy. I define white supremacy as a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe who they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists?
Obviously. Yes.
Oh, okay. Group, I want to call attention for our listeners. That would be 7 for 7. The white people that have been on this show, all 7 have said such a system exists. The non-white guests that have been on this show, 1 for 3. Very important. Just want to keep track of that. Okie dokie. Your book, The Iceman Inheritance. You actually begin this work. The first sentence in the book is, this book is racist. What do you mean when you say racist?
I mean that what I'm going to do with this book, if you'll read the second paragraph, is say that is racist because I'm saying that there are differences in racial behavior. And one of them that's significant is that the white race is more aggressive than others. And so, therefore, the book is technically racist. Is that correct? In other words, I am postulating a difference in behavior between races, and I try to define race in the book, by the way, and that I'm saying that the biggest and most significant evolutionary difference in the races is not skin color, it's not oriental eyes or anything else, it's not even white skin. It's the fact that the white race also happens to be more aggressive and seeks to dominate all others. That's what I'm saying. So that's a racist statement. So I open the book with a line, this book is racist.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Well, I'm right, aren't I? I mean, my book is racist, isn't it?
Well, I guess, again, it's very important in terms of definitions, in terms of what you mean when you say racist.
Well, that's it. I'm trying to say that there is a racial distinction. It's not intelligence, not skin color. It's aggression. And the white race is more aggressive than others. So the book was racist, so I said it.
Okay. Could you share with our listeners exactly what your purpose for writing this book? What was your purpose for writing the book, and what problem were you looking to solve in writing this book?
Okay, I will. My purpose in writing the book was to have white people like myself look at themselves in what I considered to be an objective biological mirror, something we have not done, because we've written a lot of history, mythologized a lot of history, and have seen it in terms of our own self-image, not the way other people see us. So that was my purpose in writing the book. Now, where did this come from? It came, actually, I can't add, in the summer of 1950 in Jackson, Mississippi, where I lived at that time, where the Ku Klux Klan burnt our mobile home because we were working for the integration movement down there, as it was called then.
Where was this at again?
Jackson, Mississippi.
Jackson, okay.
I was born in Alabama, but my family moved to Jackson, Mississippi. So
okay.
We were working for the integration movement, and then the Ku Klux Klan didn't like that very much, and burnt down our mobile home, and we had to flee to Chicago. And all the way, and I was bullwhipped down there. And I said, okay, now what causes all this damned hatred, you know what I mean? I don't understand it. So I devoted my life to trying to understand it in the sense of not just saying, well, it exists, but what causes it? Does it have a scientific cause that I can convince people of, an objective, factual cause? And that's what Iceman was all about. I think there is. And I think it's been in the last 8 years or so, very much supported by the anthropology that's come out of the Caucasus with regard to Homo habilis. So, but back then, those things hadn't been discovered yet. So what I did with Iceman was I took it as far back as a group of people called Neanderthals, and that's fine. There's no doubt that a partial answer, one ancestor of the white race, are Neanderthals, and there's no doubt that the Neanderthals are more aggressive than anybody else, because there's almost twice as many violence-caused injuries in Neanderthal bones than any other group of fossil human beings. So there's nothing particularly questionable about that. But that's why I did it. I hope I answered your question.
Okay. I want to restate just to make sure that I'm accurately understanding what you said, that you wrote the book Iceman Inheritance to express your theory as to why people who classify themselves as white are more aggressive. And since you said you started this with being mistreated by members of the Ku Klux Klan who could have been racist, why white people are more aggressive and practice racism, and your theory, racism, white supremacy, your theory that this is because the people who classify themselves as white evolved from Neanderthals who...
Partially. At least partially, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Partially evolved from Neanderthals that were in very frigid, glacial environments, very cold temperatures, and as a result of this environment, they adapted very aggressive behaviors, and those aggressive behaviors continue to be manifested by the people who are classified as white. Would that be correct?
That's it. Now, a few years ago, a lot of Afrocentrists sort of simplified my book by saying ice people versus sun people. And that's all very nice, but it's incorrect. What I'm saying is that there are physical adaptations, more important than color, which made a great deal of aggression within this group. A lot of it was due to adaptation and evolution within a glacial environment, yes. So I didn't ever quibble too much with ice people versus sun people, because it was, after all, generally correct. But
okay.
I, as you know, if you read the book, I go into a great deal of detail about why these physical adaptations for the Ice Age would cause aggression. It wasn't just that things were tough. It was more than that.
Would you be willing to share? I would like people to read the book, but if you would be willing to share some of the details that you go into the book in terms of why this aggressive behavior, what caused that, I guess, in being in that sort of frigid environment, that you go into in your book?
Okay, I think it was basically psychosexual. That is to say, Neanderthals had a great deal of difference between the sexes. There was a great deal of it. And I tend to think that they looked at each other, the sexes thereof, as being different species. And this got carried over into regarding any other kind of human being as a different species as well. And that was the basis of the aggression, is psychosexual gender aggression transferred to other people.
Mm-hmm. I know you go into a great deal of difference in talking about the sexual dissonance that this Neanderthal group had, and how you have seen evidence that that has continued amongst people who classify themselves as white. And you talk about how, in people who are not white, you do not see that same level of aggression between males and females in your book. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and it's, and never, and the white race is simply a fact which really all anthropologists agree with, show more differences between men and women than other races. In other words, it's called sexual dimorphism, and that's one characteristic of the Caucasians, is that they're have a higher degree of sexual dimorphism than any other race, however many you want to choose to exist. Now, that's a solidly accepted anthropological fact. It has nothing to do with Michael Bradley's assumptions. As a matter of fact, one of the people who wrote an introduction to Iceman, Dr. Judith Posner, is an anthropologist, and she said that's a solidly accepted anthropological fact. Nobody can argue with it.
Very interesting.
And so, I mean, it's not a matter of opinion.
Yes, sir. What I want to do, I want to come back to this because I found that very interesting. But I wanted
I do too. I wish I knew more about it myself. but that's what I figured was the root cause of this higher level of aggression, was a psychosexual anger, if you like.
Very interesting.
And then that gets slops over and gets carried over into your dealings with all kinds of people, whatever. And I think that's really the root of racism, is this sexism, really. That's my opinion anyway. And that's what the facts seem to indicate. But now I think there's something else, which I'd like to get into at some point.
Okay. I wanted to hop back to pick out some key points. I also wanted to take some calls as well. Individuals, if you want to call in and speak with Mr. Bradley directly, number is 347-215-6071. I'm going to get to Bandung 2. He's been hanging out, and he's calling in from another area of the world, so I definitely want to let him ask questions as well. You make a consistent point in your book of pointing out that the term race, I'm quoting you directly on page 33, that the word race had no rigid or concrete scientific definition. You say that repeatedly, that this term has not been defined adequately. It has been defined in a confusing manner. The definitions have changed over time. Would it be correct that the white people, just in the way that they have used the term race, it has been used to practice racism, white supremacy?
Absolutely.
Okay. It's good. If you could go in, I guess, because I feel like you go into quite a bit of detail about that in your book. Could you share with our listeners some of the ways in which just the usage of the term race has been used to practice racism, white supremacy?
Well, the whole idea of even bothering to classify people by race, which unfortunately has often been the most physically obvious characteristic is skin color, but it has nothing whatever to do with anything that's significant. But by classifying people that way, it was a handy, easily visually obvious way of saying other people are inferior, but we white people are not.
Wow. Under the system of white supremacy.
But I would like to say something now. You
yes,
want
sir.
Me to keep things simple, but now I'm going to go into something that's not so simple. And it's a lot deeper, and it's a lot more significant for racism than what we've been talking about.
Hold on one second. I wanted to add a couple more questions. Would it be acceptable
sure.
if I kind of finish out my line of questioning? Because this show is dedicated to racism, white supremacy. If we can finish that out, then I'll open the floor. If you can, you know, share with us everything that you like, that you feel is relevant.
Oh, I think it's super racism was what I'm going to go into.
Could you repeat that, please?
Super racism is what I was going to go into.
Oh, okay. A
race is just a variety. It's like a breed of dog, okay? It has everybody can interbreed with each other, okay? But now what I think is we're getting down to past race into there actually being two specific subspecies of humanity.
Okay. I definitely want to catch that, but there are a couple more points that I want to get to, I think are very important that you get to in your book.
Okay.
You said that Western culture, would it be correct, Western culture is, could I replace Western culture with racism, white supremacy? Would that be accurate?
Well, say that again. Western culture
I'm going to replace Western culture with white supremacy culture. Racist white supremacist culture so thoroughly permeates the world that even opposition to it relies on racist white supremacist philosophies. That's your book from page 58. Could you share exactly how that is, that even opposing the system of white supremacy, you end up relying on the philosophy of white supremacy?
Sure. Maybe the best example would be, say, communist China. They were exploited, the Chinese, by European expansion and colonialism. And to protect themselves against that, they adopted Marxism, which was actually came from the West. That's what I meant by that. The Japanese did the same thing by accepting our ideas of industrialism so they could defend themselves. In 1850, Japan was a more or less feudal society. By 1904, they were an industrial one, and they had a Western-style navy and a Western-style army, and they were able to defeat the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War. But only 50 years before that, they had been a largely feudal society.
Would you say it is at minimum problematic, the non-white people victims of white supremacy are attempting to oppose white supremacy by using philosophies that are in fact based and a product of white supremacy?
Well, I think they have up to now. That may be changing now. but I think that they have up to now. One thing I think that is really insidious, if I can use a word here, with regard to black Africans specifically, by the way, is that the black Africans adopted, to some degree, a white Middle Eastern religions, and how they can fight us by using our own religion and being propagandized and infiltrated by it, it beats me. I don't think I can do it. And I think it's an insidious development. Now, I understand now in Africa there is a movement to revive traditional African religions, and I think it's a good idea.
Very interesting. When I was researching your book, I came across an article that Mr. Henry Louis Gates, he's an online person.
Oh, my God.
he wrote, and this was totally accidental, like I said, I was just researching, you know, for the interview. And I found this article where he was very critical of your book. And then I also saw the New York Times article where you responded. Can you share with our audience, I guess, some of the criticisms that Mr. Henry Louis Gates had of your work? To be honest,
I can't, because I've never read his book. And I read an article by him in the New York Times, a full-page op-ed article. I think what really made him more angry than anything else is that when we debated each other at Yale University, the law school awarded me the debate 10 to nothing. I think they got him more angry than anything else.
Can you repeat that?
Pardon?
Can you repeat that? You said
we had a debate at Yale University, and Henry Louis Gates Jr. and me. And I've never read anything that Henry Louis Gates Jr. Wrote, except for the op-ed piece in the New York Times,
which was
demagogues and pseudo scholars or something.
Yes, sir.
But he was blasting me basically for having authored a book that other black educators were using, and because of the book's existence, then these guys could use it. Like, I've forgotten his name now. There was a guy at New York City College who was using it, and very others. Pardon? Lynn Jeffries was using it, and several other people. Tony Martin at Wellesley College was using it. And I think what Henry Louis Gates Jr. was upset about was the fact that it was a scientific book. Gates, I believe, but I may be wrong here, is an English professor. What he knows about anthropology, you can put in the thimble. And he made the mistake of getting out of his field to attack me, because there's not much you can attack except just screaming and saying, I don't like it, which is basically what he did. But he didn't say any reasons why he didn't like it.
I didn't pay attention to him. Okay.
I only read one thing he's written.
Sir, the only reason that I even brought this up, because I'm very much in support of non-white people not attacking other non-white people and criticizing anything that they have to say. The only reason I brought this up is that Mr. Henry Louis Gates is married to a white person, and I found that very interesting that he made an effort to strongly criticize your book, and he's in a sexual relationship with a white person. Very interesting, I thought. But
well,
at any rate,
a very successful relationship. Because he's also had an academic career of sort of a red carpet by saying what white people want him to say.
That's most non-white people, victims of white supremacy. I frequently am in position of having to say and do what white people want me to say. And in fact, I'm not aware of any non-white person who does not have to say and or do what white people want them to say.
Well,
and
yeah, especially you have to do it in the university if you're going to be a professor. Believe me, you do.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm not a professor at a university, and I still have to do and say what white people want me to do and say. So,
well,
I
didn't do and say what white people wanted me to say. And,
oh, but you're not white. You're not a non-white person, though.
Well, no, I'm more or less white, although there was a special law passed in Louisiana that I must be black to be able
I'm
to
sorry.
Say what I. There was a special law passed in Louisiana that I must be Negro because I had said what I had said in the Iceman Inheritance. Now I, and therefore I couldn't do certain things in Louisiana at that time. But mind you, I've never lived in Louisiana and didn't want to go there anyway. But I just thought I'd tell you.
That's kind of interesting.
So that's kind of funny.
I wanted to ask before I want to also give you the opportunity to share with us any extra information. I wanted to actually get to your essay as well about the sexual inadequacy. The essay that you you emailed me, and it's on your webpage for everybody. If you're listening live, you can go to the description of this show, and you will see a link for Mr. Bradley's website. If you are listening to the archive of this show, the web address is michaelbradley.info. If you put that in, it'll take you to his webpage, and you can see the books that he's written. He has essays, all kinds of good information there. I believe his email address is there as well, but it's michaelbradley.info.
Michael Bradley, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y, you might say.
There you go.
Because I sometimes misspell it.
There you go, sir. On page 22 of your essay, you said, and this is going back to the sexual inadequacy that you were speaking about earlier, you said, whatever their cause or genetic origin, the psychosexual maladaptions of Ice Age Neanderthals contributed to an element of male sexual inadequacy and male emotional maturity and sexual and reproductive activity that has characterized culture and societies from the Caucasus since the beginning of recorded history. Compensation for these feelings of sexual inadequacy and psychosexual ambivalence have contributed a great deal to the genetic aggression and anti-feminism of people from the Caucasus. When I read that, I immediately thought of just the plethora of instances of non-white aggression, white aggression against non-white people that has been centered around sex. The lynchings of non-white people where non-white males have been castrated, the Emmett Till case, instances that just go on and on and on of non-white males being abused with regards to sex.
Non-white females being enslaved.
Yes, and raped. In fact, I just saw an article that was talking about how President Obama, his grandfather in Kenya, white people there, placed his grandfather's testicles in a vice grip. If you could, I guess, share your view on how this white male's sexual inadequacy being consistently expressed in aggression and violent behavior against non-white people and frequently against the sexual organs of non-white males and females, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think it's all fairly obvious. If you have sexual inadequacy yourself, then you take it out on somebody else's sex organs, right? Who are maybe, on the average anyway, larger than yours. And I think the essence of this, though, is a curse in the Talmud against black people with their shamefully black male with their shamefully large sex organs, and that this is in Talmud, and this is a part of because the Jewish tradition is really the part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and therefore the religion of most white people. This sexual thing is at the very foundation of these religions from the Middle East. And by that I would include Judaism and Islam and all their offshoots like Judeo-Christianity, the various flavors of Christianity, and the various flavors of Judaism. But that's the basis of it. That's how the culture, this white supremacist culture, defined itself, by these religions, what I call Middle Eastern religions. Unfortunately, most of the world has been subjected to that, and there's plenty of people, including a lot of black people, who consider themselves Christians. And how any black person can really see much in Christianity beats me, but they seem to do it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to point out, it is my view, in terms of religion, the system of white supremacy is a religion. And I define religion as a strong set of beliefs backed by action. Do you think that would be correct to say that white supremacy is a religion?
Well, I don't know about that, but it's certainly an opinion. But I would like to say to you that the religions developed by white people have all been racist.
Okay.
Maybe we're both saying the same thing, but from different ends of the argument. Look, there's a whole lot of evidence that Jesus was, let's say, a little bit of the dark side, as they might say down south, and that Mary Magdalene was too. Now, for some reason, you tell me why, there's 300 odd, I think, Shrine of the Black Madonnas in Europe. Now, how come? Cleopatra, who was involved in all this as well, was described as dusky up until Shakespeare. Now, the point of it is back in biblical times with Jesus, there's quite a bit of evidence that Jesus would have been called, well, he would have been called a black by some of my former colleagues in the South. But all that was changed to make him a nice white savior. But the fact of the matter is, he probably was not. And this, again, will be more complicated than you probably want to get into. But there's quite a bit of evidence that the person that we call Jesus was an Egyptian, not from the Holy Land, and not Jewish, and that the evidence genetic was that he was black, or at least a person, let's put it this way, a person of color. Now, all this was changed in the Bible to make him white.
Very interesting.
And also the Statue of Liberty in New York City. The first Statue of Liberty, of course, was donated by the French people. And the first Statue of Liberty had nothing to do with liberty in terms of just, you know, liberty as the way we have it now. It was specifically that statue was the liberation of the black slaves. That's what the French gave us that statue for. And the original statue, the Statue of Liberty, is at the French Cultural Center in New York City. The Americans wouldn't accept it until the girl, the Statue of Liberty, was properly Caucasian and properly white, and liberty was an abstract concept. But the first one was a black woman, nude, breaking the shackles of slavery.
Wow.
Those were hidden from view.
Wow. I had never heard that.
That's correct.
I want to I want to give someone, because we have a couple callers, I want to give them an opportunity to ask questions. Bandung 2, you are on the air. Feel free to ask Mr. Bradley your question or comment.
I'm Michael Bradley.
Michael Bradley, I'm sorry. Bandung 2, go right ahead, sir. Bandung 2, are you there, sir? I can hear him, I believe. Bandung 2, you are live on the air. You can ask Michael Bradley if you have questions or comments. Go right ahead, please.
I do. Can you hear me?
Yes, of course.
Okay. I don't know if you remember, Michael Bradley. We had some discussion and some exchanges a few years ago. My name is Dr. Syed Mustafa Ali.
Perhaps, yes. I don't know. A doctor?
Yeah, it was Dr. Syed Mustafa Ali. We had a number of exchanges about four or five years ago.
By email.
That's
right?
Correct.
By email. Yes, I remember something about that. You didn't like me very much.
I don't remember offering any judgment whatsoever as to your person. It was an exchange of ideas.
No, but you didn't like my ideas very much, is what I meant.
Okay, well, on that basis, now that you've clarified, I could say that my thinking maybe has changed somewhat, perhaps developed over time. I think the concerns I have, and some of them are being evidenced during the course of this program, that there is what I perceive to be a lot of obfuscation and confusion surrounding the interpretation of a number of issues, in particular this concept of Middle Eastern religion, without defining exactly what is meant by religion, what the term Middle East means, and situating that in the context of the CALS program, which is looking at the context of white supremacy. You have referred to a plurality of races without even defining the term race itself. Now, earlier in the program, Gus mentioned that he would ask you whether the system of white supremacy racism existed, and you affirmed that it did. You also affirmed that you are a white person. In the system of white supremacy racism, does that mean that you are a white supremacist and racist?
No, I don't think I am personally. But I happen to be white, yes. I'm one of the few white people, maybe, who sees us the way other people may see us. I don't want to get into any word games here.
These aren't word games. These are attempts at clarification. I'm trying to think through a process of understanding here and just trying to follow the logic of the discussion.
Well, okay. So,
okay. Can I ask you a more specific question? Because you've clarified for me now pretty much the fact that you don't, or you know, if I'm wrong, please correct me. You don't automatically believe that white person in a system of racism, white supremacy, automatically is a white supremacist racist. Would that be correct?
I don't think that every white person is necessarily a racist, a white supremacist, no. But I think that a lot of them are.
Okay. I'd like to bring in a slightly different distinction, if you like, or classification that has appeared in the literature in a work entitled The Racial Contract by Charles W. Mills. I don't know if you're familiar with that work.
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, just to sum it up very quickly, and then to ask the question again. Mills uses the notion of the social contract, which goes back to some European philosophers like Kant, Rousseau, Locke, and others, the idea of a social contract. And he argues that underpinning the social contract is, if we think about the social contract as a horizontal contract, a contract between people, he argues that there is a vertical contract that underpins that, and that is between people who are classified as human and partake in the social contract, and those who are classified as subhuman. Okay, so you have a, if you like, a horizontal relationship, which is the social contract, and a vertical relationship, which is the racial contract. Now, on that basis, if one is to agree with this, he has argued that there are signatories to the racial contract, i.e. those who constructed this racial contract. And it's a concept. He's not necessarily saying that people sat down one day and wrote out a contract.
Yeah. No, of course not.
But
it just evolved.
It's a conceptual framework. Yeah, it's a conceptual framework, essentially. And he's saying that although not every white person is or was a signatory to the contract, however, all white people are beneficiaries of the contract.
I think
it's the equivalent, for example. Sorry.
Nothing. Go ahead.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, I'm going to say it's the equivalent of, I mean, given that it's an American show, it's the equivalent of having maybe a club card with Walmart. That, you know, if you carry the club card, you're in the club. You're entitled to the benefits, the privileges, the power, et cetera, associated with belonging to that club. By default.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a system of white supremacy racism, any person classified as white or who self-classifies as white and is recognized by other white and or non-white people as white is automatically entitled to the unjust privileges that accrue from membership in that system.
Yes, I can see what you mean, yes.
I mean, it's like the idea of white privilege, that it's a kind of de facto entitlement. Now, if that is the case, then it would mean that unless white people are actively resisting the racial contract, i.e., you know, metaphorically, they're tearing the contract up and turning race traitor, then they can only be regarded as racial suspects. All white people must be regarded as racial suspects.
Okay, I don't know. Okay, so what?
Well, the point I'm now arguing is, if you classify yourself as a white person and you accept the existence of a system of global racism, white supremacy, and that you accept that there's a system of privilege and entitlement that accrues purely by virtue of being white, then unless you are thinking, speaking, and or acting constantly against this system, you must be considered racially suspect at all times.
Yeah, I think I've done my bit in that regard.
So you'd agree with that?
By the way, you're sort of fading in and out. It's sometimes difficult for me to get the continuity of what you're saying. Your phone seems like it's fading in and out, but I'm getting the drift, but I don't know what this means. In other words,
well,
I would agree with you, I suppose, but there's some of us who really have tried to speak out against this. I think Iceman Inheritance is one book that has. And I can tell you it's not easy because, let's say, a black person can say whatever he wants about whites, and nobody really pays that much attention. But when a white person says something the whites don't like to hear, as I did in Ice Man Inheritance, boy, is there ever a backlash to that.
I accept that. I accept that. One of the things, more specific things about the book I'd like to ask you is a...
Pardon?
Am I still online?
Yes, sir.
I can't hear you, Gus. Okay. Something's wrong.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Well, you're going in and out. Like you're...
Okay, I'll...
It's like there's a bad switch on your phone.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. Apologies for that.
Okay.
I haven't managed to read the entirety of The Iceman Inheritance. I mean, I started reading it about 5 years ago. and got sidetracked into reading some of the literature. But I read about the first, say, 20 pages, and I get the gist of the argument. One of the things that I find very interesting is that on page, I think it's page 33 of the book, and the chapter entitled The Concept of Race, you state that our Caucasoid aggression isn't innate and immutable, isn't racial in the sense that the popular prejudice assumes. It results from evolution and cultural experiences. Our predisposition for aggression is genetic only in the sense that environment and culture have tended to select aggression and preserve individuals exhibiting it. Now, the question I'd like to ask you is essentially a rephrasing of a question that I saw asked by another victim of racism, white supremacy, and another counter-racist a few years ago. It was either, I think, Josh Witt or John Bilal, either of whom I think is connected with counterracism.com or thecode.net. And the question that was asked is as follows, that if one tries to make the argument that the basis of white supremacy is aggression, and that aggression is at least partially, if not substantially, genetically driven, then isn't this just another instance of attempting to naturalize, thereby depoliticize, a power relation dynamic? Because in naturalizing an unjust power relation, you essentially disempower the victim from challenging the injustice inherent in the power relation on account of the fact that the relation is natural and you can't blame the oppressor for his or her aggression or oppression.
Well,
your response?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I think you're just talking sophistry here. I think that, yes, there's a genetic predilection toward a higher level of aggression in Caucasians. However, I also believe that can be overcome by the exercise of culture and intelligence. So it's not sort of either or. It can be done. It's not easy, but it can be done.
I wanted to, Bandung, hang on 1 second. I wanted to get a quick question in, and I was hoping, I had a caller, 804, who wanted to ask a question. I wanted to get his question as well, if he'll ring us in. Number again is 347-215-6071. I wanted to ask Mr. Bradley, it has been my experience. I have heard different non-white people who are familiar with your work, have read your book, and what I have seen is that non-white people will just say, yeah, these white people, they stomp around in caves. They're just, you know, no good ice people. They lived in caves and are savages and blah, blah, blah. It never really gets to what non-white people should be doing to solve the problem of the system of white supremacy. You pointed out in your book that I believe you were talking at the end of the book and you pointed out five different scenarios of how things can go in terms of white people's aggression, a.k.a. the system of white supremacy. And I wanted to know exactly what you think we should be doing as white people and non-white people. What should we be doing to solve the problem of white supremacy?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that. I've been wondering about that all my life. To be perfectly blunt and honest, I don't believe that a damn thing can be done about it. I believe that we're either going to blow up the planet or the whites are going to try to rule it. I think that's the name of the game.
Okay. I have taken the position as a non-white person, a victim of white supremacy, I have taken the position that white people, I don't see any evidence that would suggest they are going to change their behavior. I don't see any.
I don't either.
Oh, okay. Oh, what? Okay. So would you say then that for the non-white people, the victims of white supremacy, if this is going to change, it would be on the non-white people to change their behavior, and that it might not be constructive to invest time and energy in trying to get white people to stop practicing racism, white supremacy.
Look, I don't know exactly what you're asking me.
I get a
sense of it. Here's what I would do. I'd try to make myself as independent of the white infrastructure as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I would actively oppose it. That's about the only thing you think you can do. Now, I believe that there's difficulties here, and there's also some misapprehensions here, but we haven't had a chance to get into those yet. But I believe that, basically speaking, this Caucasian group, and especially the ones from the Middle East, are either going to try to control this world or destroy it. And I think they'd rather destroy it if they can't control it.
I have come to the same conclusion, and anybody that's listening, I think white people have even made a movie showing this. If you watch Planet of the Apes, particularly if you watch Beneath Planet of the Apes, when the white people are not able to control the non-whites, the apes in the movie, they blow up the earth when they're no longer able to control it. That's how Beneath the Planet of the Apes ends, and
well,
that blows up the planet.
I think that's, to be perfectly honest, I think that's what we're seeing in the Middle East right now. I would like to remind you that the term Caucasian means the Caucasus Mountains. And the most aggressive strain of white people in terms of religion, control, sexual, I don't know, mix-up, whatever, comes from this region, which I call the Middle East. That is to say, the Caucasus is right smack in the middle of the Middle East, and those people radiated out from there to influence people to a greater or lesser extent east and west, and especially in the mountains and in Palestine, in the mountains of the Hindu Kush, Pamirs, Elbers, and whatnot that are connected with the Caucasus. Now, if you map this distribution of aggression, there's very little doubt. That's why I call it Middle Eastern, because it's smack dab in the middle of the Middle East. Now, everything coming from there, the white supremacy and the religions and the anti-feminism and the aggression, that all comes basically from the Middle East. I think that there are two major subspecies of mankind, one that's in the Middle East and sort of had its influence both east and west from there. But the fringes of Europe, like Ireland and whatnot, have much more in common with blacks than they do with people from the Middle East in terms of religion, racism, and all the rest of it. The people in China have Turkmenistan, the area around the town of Zizan, where you get a change from Caucasian to Oriental mankind. They have much more in common with, let's put it this way, the people in the Middle East are the odd man out in terms of their religions, their anti-feminism, their extreme level of aggression. And that's why I postulate there are two subspecies of mankind. One from the Middle East is still there, and it's also gone to North America, and in terms of mostly Jewish immigration, but now some Arab too. But Islam, Judaism, the difference between them is negligible, but what they have in common is a great deal of anti-feminism, a great deal of aggression, just read the Bible, and it's all part and parcel of this thing.
Wow. I'm Ben Dung to bring you back to ask you a question. I wanted to ask before I brought Ben Dung to that. I wanted to make a statement, and you can tell me what you think about it. That under the system of white supremacy, that either non-white people, the victims of white supremacy, are not informed enough about what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works,
and where it came from, and how it works. Yeah.
Okay.
They're not. They're not well enough informed because they haven't looked at it. Okay. They've accepted certain things at face value, like Islam or a Judeo-Christian tradition. And now, by the way, I remembered what, is it Sayed that was on the phone?
Oh,
yes, you and I talked.
Yeah, I'm bringing him back in whenever you
I remember now what it was that we disagreed on in those emails a long time ago. It was mostly his defense of Islam as a religion, and I have no patience with that.
Okay.
I have no patience with that at all.
Okay.
I'm not about to start having any either. I got better things to do.
Okay. But you, I was going to read a three-part statement if I could finish. You already said that you feel non-white people, the victims of white supremacy, are not informed enough about racism, white supremacy. What I was going to ask is, do you think that the non-white people are not informed enough about white supremacy, or the system of white supremacy is so strong that being informed about it is not enough to help non-white people overcome it, or both? I was going to ask which one of those you think is accurate, if you have a view.
Well, I do. First of all, nobody, not even white people, know enough about why there's white aggression and white supremacy. And number two, no, I don't think things are going to help much except opposition to it, and that may be armed opposition to it.
Okay. I want to be very clear because I didn't say why white supremacy is practiced. I said how.
Well, I don't know how because I haven't lived in this for a long time. I'm virtually a recluse. I don't like the whole situation very much, so I just stay out of it.
I write what
I can. I make it available, but I don't get involved in it. I just stay in my little apartment and don't go out. And also, I have a heart condition, which makes it harder. So, but it also makes it more convenient. I don't know what the solutions are. I don't think there is one.
Okay. 619, you are on the air.
Thank you, Gus, for your program. And, Mr. Bradley, I read your book probably about 19 years ago. I think it was seminal in helping me develop my own theory. I wanted to see how it resonated with you. And my theory is that that sexuality is at the core, that it is the basis of racism, white supremacy, and that it does have to do with hostility between the white male and the white female. That, in fact, in spite of the propaganda that has been spread through the media that they are the sexual ideals for themselves and everyone else, that in actuality, they do not find each other physically attractive. And I think that you can see that in popular media more times than not. If you see a white male and a white female engaged in some toward sex act, 9 times out of 10, they will do it with their clothes on. And that I think that the white female is actually angry with the white. I think they're angry with each other because each is aware that they are not the preference of the other. And the white male is particularly angry with the white female because she makes him work so hard to provide material things in order to keep herself sexually available to him. That if he did not provide those things for her, bring her the whole world by conquering everyone else, she would definitely choose what is, you know, more adaptive to a planet in the solar system, which is a darker-skinned male. I'd like to get your comments on that.
I don't know. I did say something very similar in The Iceman Inheritance, I believe. And I've also always talked about psychosexual ambivalence and aggression being at the root of this racism business. And I've always said that. I don't think about it very much, but I've consistently said that's the root of it. So
okay.
I agree with you. But
okay.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think, is Gus there?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's what I said in my book. I think that you read a passage which was exactly that.
I read that from your essay.
About 15 minutes ago, you read it?
Yes, that's actually in your essay. That's not in the Iceman Inheritance book. If you go to Mr. Bradley's website, michaelbradley.info.com, the passage that I read about the sexual maladaption of white males is on an essay. Esau's Empire, I believe, is the title of it.
Esau's Empire 1 and 2. Now, I've said that. I think I sort of hinted at it, though, even Iceman 78.
Yes, sir.
I hinted at it, but my thoughts have evolved since 78, you know. So I'm more inclined toward the opinion that a lot of this racism, which is what concerns this show, actually has its root in sexism, for lack of a better word. So I basically agree with your caller.
Okay, and I just had one more comment, and I just definitely need to preface it by saying that I am not advocating that anyone do what I'm proposing would be psychologically devastating to white supremacy. I'm not advocating it at all. I hope that it does not happen. However, I think that if the planes had flown into the big white obelisk, which is symbolic of the white male, the power of the white male phallus. If someone had flown into that, the one into Washington, D.C., I think there would have been much, it would have been far more psychologically devastating and would have dealt a far bigger blow to white supremacy than the planes that flew into the World Trade Centers. And with that, I will hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, 619. I wanted to check Bandung to Dr. Ali. I apologize, no disrespect. Dr. Ali, if you're there, you have a question or comment, sir.
Yeah, am I online?
You're alive, sir.
Okay. Yeah, just in response to the last caller's comment, I mean, the jury's still out regarding who exactly responsible for September the 11th, and that's a completely different issue. But in terms of the implications of targeting an iconic structure, the phallus symbol, the monument, as opposed to the Twin Towers, from my position, neither of those damaged this white supremacy. Because people aren't able to understand the implications of those kind of acts in the context of globally operating system of racism, white supremacy. And people think because an event takes place and that there seems to be some super action on the part of presumably non-white victims of white supremacy targeting, in quotes, the center of white supremacy, the power structure, assuming as a center, which again betrays a kind of lack of understanding of what white supremacy is as a globally operating system. I mean, the idea of the system is that it doesn't necessarily have a center. The system functions, it's distributed. It's not centralized. It's not as if there's a kind of pyramid and that somehow the United States is the apex of the system of white supremacy. I would reject that kind of understanding. And so any symbolic collateral or revenue that could be generated through that kind of act, I don't think that addresses the whole issue of what's being targeted. I mean, one doesn't go up against white supremacy by knocking out a phallus. Even if made of concrete or marble, I think that completely misses the point. I understand that the point that's being made, and I'm sympathetic because, I mean, clearly that's a non-white person.
Understood. I don't, Mr. Bradley, if you have a comment.
The nature of the system.
I think I want to get off the phone now. I think this. I've said what I had to say. People can agree or disagree with it. I don't really care. I think I'm going to go off the phone now. Bye.
Thank you, sir. Groovy, Mr. Michael Bradley. I felt the most constructive thing that was said. He is a white person, and he does not believe white people are going to stop practicing racism, white supremacy. That was really the most important thing that I heard for the duration of the conversation. White people are not going to stop practicing racism, white supremacy. Always I have a caller at 253. 253, are you there?
Hey, yes. I actually had a question for Mr. Bradley, and apparently I think he just disappeared, didn't he? Or I mean,
yes, sir.
Did he hang up?
Yes, sir. I don't. If you want to share your question, we'd be curious to know what you, or at least I'm curious to know what you were going to ask.
I was just going to know, you know, as much as he can recall, I want to know what the language used. When they determined the law against him in Louisiana, I think you said.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
I just wanted to, yeah, how that, you know, what language was used in determining that.
I would have been interested to hearing his response to that question. Wow, we have a non-white person who's saying that they felt Mr. Bradley was a terrible guest. I think it would be most accurate to say, I suspect he could have been practicing racism. I suspect he could have shared perhaps more informative information, could have perhaps been a little more helpful. But, hey, if he does not believe the system of white supremacy is going to end and that white people are going to continue to practice racism, white supremacy, he's a white person. He's doing what he's supposed to do. He's doing it. He's on his job, I suspect. He's on his job. I don't know. I don't know how much of the interview that you heard, 253. How did you feel about what Mr. Bradley had to say?
I can't say I found much of it constructive. Yeah. I mean, I'm more so wanting to know what information he directly could share that could help solve the problem and the race problem that is. And he didn't seem to want to offer up much of that.
He doesn't think it can be solved. I either suspect,
right, exactly.
Yeah, either I suspect that is true. He doesn't think anything can be done about it, so he has nothing to share. Or I suspect he's practicing racism, white supremacy, and he's not going to share constructive information that would help replace white supremacy with justice. And I guess both could be true. So, yeah, again, he's a white person. I mean, hey, adjust expectations accordingly. Dr. Ali, I apologize. You're still with us on the air. If you could plug your blog again and share your thoughts about our guest, Mr. Michael Bradley.
Apologies, Gus. I didn't catch last comments. It's like connection problem here. Could you just repeat that?
Yes, sir. I said if you could please tell our listeners your blog address one more time, and if you could share your thoughts on what you heard from Mr. Bradley.
Sure. The blog is bandung2.blog.co.uk. My thoughts about Michael Bradley, well, I think you pretty much summed it up, both you and the previous caller. The most constructive things he said was that he accepts the existence of a globally operating system of racism, white supremacy. He self-identifies as white. He doesn't believe that the system doesn't see the way. I think armed uprising against white supremacy. He doesn't seem to say that the system can be replaced with a system of justice. But from my perspective, and I have to be completely honest with all the listeners on this show, I'm coming at this as a a struggling Muslim, as an individual who struggles to self-surrender to the all power on a daily basis. And my counter-racism as a non-white victim of racism, white supremacy, is informed by an Islamic perspective. But I should try to qualify that by saying, by Islam, I'm not about Islam as a religion, or as the religion that perhaps your listeners may be familiar with, but rather trying to root it back to the code, which is codified in the Quran. And the probably the best way to understand what the Quran is, it defines itself in the Arabic language as it's a proclamation to human beings. That's all it is. It's a proclamation to human beings from the All Power. That's its claim. And my engagement with Nabi on this show really has to be seen, I think, in terms of my exchanges with him over possibly maybe 12 to 24 months, about 4 years ago, via email, a series of increasingly heated exchanges between me as a, at that time, a Muslim who wasn't really too aware of the existence of the system of race and white supremacy. I certainly my but somebody who was probably clued enough understand that there was a great deal of confusion, which I believe to have been intended on his part in attempting to mask the source of the problem. If you notice, during the course of the show, he introduced a plethora of different ideas, terms, concepts, and reference points. I mean, of the term Caucasoid, the Caucasus Mountains, Middle East, we had reference to Judaism, Judeo-Christianity, Islam, religion. So the discourse shifted between geography, theology, and from my perspective, I'm not saying that I was necessarily constructive or that I was even asking the clearest of questions. I mean, I'm trying to refine thought, speech, and/or action on a daily basis. But my attempts were try to draw out from him what I believe to be a degree, possibly intentional use of confusing flash on his part.
I agree with you, sir. I agree. I think his book would be much more constructive for non-white people if he just summed it up very quickly. There's a system of racism, white supremacy. I'm a white person, and I don't believe white people are going to stop practicing racism, white supremacy. If he had just said that, fantastic. I would still suspect that he is a racist, but I would say that would be great. Now, all the extra information that he has about why white people practice racism and white supremacy, that's interesting reading. I think for a non-white person to know that there are white people who suspect that there could be a biological motivating factor that pushes white people to practice white supremacy, which is what the Iceman Inheritance is basically doing. You have non-white people who are saying that they suspect there could be a biological motivating factor that is pushing white people to practice white supremacy. That would be Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing and her work. If you've got two pretty informed individuals saying there's a biological component to this, as Mr. Bradley said, it might be white people are not going to say racism, white supremacy. If that could be true, and evidence suggests that that's true, non-white people are going to have to take a serious look at this problem and say, hey, white people are not going to change. If this problem is going to be solved, non-white people are going to have to change our behavior. That is the only way this problem is going to be solved. I could be incorrect. Caller 253, I don't, if you had a comment or, you know, anything you'd like to say, sir.
Just to comment on what you just said, I mean, that's, I agree with you. You know, I mean, that would be the logical move for non-white people who have a desire to eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, would be to modify their behavior in a way that works against that system.
For sure. Van Dung, too, I wanted to also give you an opportunity. I wish you had been here last week because I was very interested in getting your commentary with regards to Mr. or Dr. Kevorkian. If you would like to say anything about that or anything else about Mr. Bradley, feel free to do so.
Well, for that, I have to say that I probably think better on the page than I do top of my head in conversation.
Okay.
So in a way, I think the blog is probably one of the best forums for me to try to do patient, detailed, sustained, critical. And, my unsuccessful attempt last week in trying to get on this show actually was a catalyst for me to go away and blog on the blog itself, Color Monitor, and on contents of the program. And, you know, and if people are interested, they can go to the blog and they can have a look at the post, which is, I think it's called Monitoring Color Monitors.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I mean, the points I was trying to make is that, you know, I found the book very interesting. I come from a computer science, artificial intelligence background, and I have some philosophical training as well. And it certainly has galvanized me to go back to the and start to perform counter-racist analysis of the area of artificial intelligence, cyborgs, man-machine or human-machine symbiosis. That whole area of technology for kind of counter-racist analysis. And, you know, credit where credit is due, Kevorkian has at least opened up the field to, you know, to analysis. But I have to say that, and this I brought this point out in the blog, and you've commented on this, Gus, but the fact that the book closes with such a kind of confused literary chapter, in my mind, kind of deflates the whole of the book. And this kind of appeal to into a kind of neutral language, you know, he evokes French philosopher Bruno Latour's idea of hybrid networks. I mean, he talks about the networks of human and non-human as a kind of means of getting, you know, beyond what he regards as kind of binary opposition of white and non-white. I mean, it sounds really, you know, well and good until you read very closely in text, because if you bear in mind the central argument of that black equals machine and machine equals black, or machine equals non-human equals black, and vice versa, then if you're saying that in shifting from binary black-white to this idea of the hybrid network, humans and non-humans, what you're essentially saying is, yeah, you're going to maintain a hybrid network made up of humans and non-humans. And who are these non-humans? I mean, are they white? Are they black? What are they? That point was very unclear in the text. And I don't know whether it was just a failure on the part, you know, a genuine failure, or whether it was intentional. And because, you know, I as a human being cannot have access to intent, I have to be suspicious, specifically because a white person who maintained that he was also a white supremacist in a system of global racism, white supremacy. So that was one of the points. You know, I attempted to kind of draw to attend anyone who's interested in reading the material on the blog. The other one is that these kind of arguments by appeal to moving beyond the binary, I feel to be absolutely destructive or non-constructive for a non-white victim of race supremacy, because we need this position. I mean, Fuller in his code book. Distinction, because I think that apart from there being white people who function as white supremacists and white people who are incapable of functioning as white supremacists, for example, disabled people, perhaps children who haven't been completely assimilated into the system of white supremacy practice and or belief, and as well as people who are, you know, old and unable to function. There are all race traitors. There is always the possibility of the race traitor, and I, as a kind of maybe subtext alluded to in the code book. I mean, I don't necessarily see anything that Fuller has said that would negate that. And also bear in mind that you know, with due respect to Neely Fuller and his seminal work, he never claimed that the code book was the last word on counter-racism. In fact, he said the exact opposite in the book. It's a starting point on which to build. And the non-white to have among themselves in order to manufacture, create a shared vocabulary that can empower us, first of all, in an understanding of
You're breaking up a little bit there, Dr. Ali. Hang on one second. I'm going to keep you online. 214, are you there? 214, are you there? 214, you're live if you have a question or comment.
Hi, I'm just listening.
Oh, okay. Hang on. Dr. Ali, apologies. You're breaking up quite a bit. Not sure if it's a connection problem or what have you. I'm gonna come back to you though. Stay on the line. I'm gonna come back to you if your line has cleared up at all. I want to thank everyone tuning in to Cal's Context of White Supremacy. Please check out the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. If you can share information, if you feel the broadcasts are constructive, if they have anything helpful in terms of how you understand racism, white supremacy, and if you feel like you get any constructive information and or suggestions about what should be done counter racism, white supremacy. Want to point out Back of the Bus, check out his blog, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. Back of the Bus, he wanted me to point out why I use the term non-white. And today's show, anyway, would be a brilliant illustration of why I use the term non-white. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Mr. Bradley, before he exited quickly, did say, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Everyone who is not white is abused and mistreated. In my view, all of the people who are not white are suffering and being mistreated by white people. As a non-white person myself, I have found that I have been much more constructive in terms of being able to talk about racism, white supremacy, get more information about racism, white supremacy, using the term non-white. I'm classified as a so-called black person. If I was just using the term black in dealing with racism, white supremacy, I would really be missing out on a big chunk of people who are victimized by white supremacy. Just in this show alone, I had a non-white person who is not black, a so-called Asian person, who was able to help me get Mr. Bradley's book so that I could read it and be a little more informed in doing this interview. If I was just using the term black, it's very possible that I would not have had contact with this person, and we would not be exchanging information, constructive information, on racism, white supremacy. Just in being able to have access to a phone to do this show, had to have contact with a non-white person who is not black. So-called Asian person. Definite shout out, Susie, who sticking in there, allowing me to use the phone so that I could do this program. If I was not using the term non-white, it is very probable I would not have had contact with her. We would not have exchanged constructive information on racism, white supremacy. It is my view for the non-white people, it would be most constructive if we are using the term non-white. That is the most accurate term to use, and you catch everybody who is being abused and stomped on by white people. You all can all work together. It really gives you opportunities to interact with more people, more victims of white supremacy. If that's the problem you're trying to solve, you want to catch everybody who is not white, who is being victimized by the system, to work together to attempt to solve problems. And this show, excellent example of what can happen when you make a serious effort to catch all of those people, being in contact with as many victims of white supremacy, non-white people, as possible, helps me solve problems to do this show all the way through. Non-white people working together to give me the book, to give me the phone, doing as much as possible so that we're working together to solve our problems and to work against the white people who practice racism, white supremacy. I know I've had several people say they don't like the use of the term non-white. They'd rather use other terms. They'd rather use the term black and all these other terms. You know, I respect anyone if they want to use terms, but I think it's most accurate and it's just constructive to use the term non-white victim of white supremacy. That's my view, and I can say, again, this show would be evidence as to why I think that is constructive, sharing information and getting other experiences, but I could be incorrect. I also wanted to point out I am not a counter-racist. I am working to be a counter-racist. I am a victim of white supremacy, working my best to be a counter-racist, and that'll be true as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I'm going to go to the phone line really quick. Did you have a comment or question?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
As-salamu alaykum. Peace and blessings. How are you?
I am very well. Another victim of white supremacy who was instrumental in getting today's show off the ground, having major problems prior to the show, started a little late, and victim of white supremacy on the phone line now, was there to place a call to Mr. Bradley so that he was informed, and he called in a little later. Absolutely crucial in getting today's show off. Thank you 1,000 times. Do you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast?
No, I don't. I knew he was practicing white supremacy.
Did you feel he shared constructive information, or did you feel like he was here to assist the non-white people in working against racism, white supremacy?
No.
Wow.
It's just, you know how he used words, and I picked up on that.
Very interesting. Very interesting. What did you think about him saying that he does not believe there is a solution to the system of white supremacy?
That means he wants to keep it in power. In my opinion. He doesn't want to take part in solving the problem. So.
Wow. Wow. Did you catch? I'm glad, caller 253, I'm glad he made a point of that. Did you catch when he said he was classified as black in a certain area of the world?
Yeah, in Louisiana, yeah.
Like, wow, dude. Yeah, this is what you should expect. Oh, thank you, RNLA 76. Thank you for listening. I appreciate the supporters. Yeah, and she was saying, I hope RNLA 76, she was saying, when Dr. Ali, when he was questioning him, she was saying, you know, don't let callers attack the guest. And I was saying, you know, I don't feel Mr. Bradley is being attacked. We're just, you know, asking questions and, you
right.
know, trying to get constructive information. We're not attacking. And he eventually stormed off the interview when I don't feel anyone was being disrespectful. I think people were just presenting their views and,
right.
you know, asking
right.
questions, trying to solve a problem, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and he's written a book about, you know, this problem does exist and is a great, you know, cancer on the world, he says in his book. He's very explicit about saying, you know, white people are causing all of the major problems on the planet right now.
Right.
You know. But again, dealing with white people, got to keep your expectations very much in line that we are in a system of white supremacy, and these people, if they are able, probably are practicing white supremacy. Please plug your blogs and your Ning site, please, for our listeners.
I have a blogspot called Frisky Kitty Counter Racism Blogspot, and I basically talk about white supremacy.
Gangster, and you also have a Ning that talks about racism, white supremacy in the health industry. Can you tell them?
Yes. What was that? I can't hear you.
I said Rising Phoenix. Could you plug your name as well, please?
Yeah, it's called the Rising Phoenix Health Network also. And pretty soon I'm going to be starting a radio show about the subject. So hopefully it's going to come up soon. I just need to get out of my nervousness. I'm nervous right now just talking about it.
It can make you very nervous. I know I'm frequently a little anxious before each program, especially if I'm talking to a white person, because I don't know if they're going to present me with constructive information or be, you know, talking about everything under the sun or if I'm going to be mistreated. It's an interesting bag of tricks when you are dealing with white people. But, we need more help. I will definitely be a supporter. Once you get your show up, I'll be in the chat room. Listening in and promoting and telling folks to check it out. We need more informed folks to share constructive information. Let us know, please, when you get your show up. My man Dr. Ali, he called us back in. Let me see if Dr. Ali, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm going to be a better connection now. I'm closer to my wireless hub, so hopefully the signal strength should be better. Am I coming through clearer now?
I hear you pretty clear now, sir. Go right ahead.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. I broke connection for a little while, so I'm not sure whether it's appropriate for me to talk any more about Martin Kevorkian. Has the conversation moved on?
Hey, we're victims and non-white people. I couldn't even start the show on time. Feel free to share your view. If you could tell us what area of the world you are calling from, that would be constructive.
Okay, I'm calling from the area of the world classified as Europe, in particular the United Kingdom, and even more specifically, London, England.
Okay, great. I just wanted to point that out. We had a total so-called international counter-racist effort today. Caller from Europe. Mr. Bradley was calling from Canada. We have callers all over the so-called United States. So complete international counter-racist effort today. Go right ahead, Dr. Ali.
Okay, thanks for that. The couple of points I really wanted to make in connection with Kevorkian's presentation, I made one of them earlier, but the point I wanted to follow up that a lot of the discourse, particularly the school surrounding analysis of colonialism, imperialism, which I just consider to be euphemisms for racism, white supremacy, synonyms essentially. A lot of the discourse revolves around so-called postmodern criticism. You know, there are strategies within that whole area of discourse, philosophical, sociological, linguistic, literary, etc. But there's also an incredible amount of confusion. And I have to say, as a non-white victim of racism, white supremacy, and somebody who has a little bit of training in philosophy, that I like to move in the direction of considering modernism as yet another refinement of thought, speech, and or action within the system of racism, white supremacy. On that basis, I mean, in the blog entry that I wrote following Kevorkian being on your show last week, I mentioned two texts, one by a non-white person entitled Postmodernism, the New Imperialism of Western Culture by Ziauddin Sardar, a non-white person resident in the UK of Pakistani descent. And the other one was by a white author named Aaron Garr, and the book is entitled Postmodernism, Mental Crisis. And the interesting thing about both of these books, and the only reason I even bother to mention them in the blog entry and on your show, is that they seem to be saying the same thing, and that is that postmodernism, I mean, one of its central ideas is that kind of like everything is relative. There are no absolutes, no truths, there are no systems of thought anymore, there are no grand ideas, grand meta-narratives, if you like, unifying narratives. Everything is up for grabs. And one of the implications of this is that if everything is relative and anything goes, well, if anything goes, that's the same as saying that everything's. Yeah, because if everything's relative, there's no reason to replace one thing with another thing. There's no standard, there's no criterion by which to evaluate or determine other than a completely relativistic criterion. There's no absolute standard anymore because there's no great meta-narrative. They're just different competing stories, discourses, frameworks, theories, etc. And I consider postmodernism looked in that sense to be a mask concealing the asymmetry of power relations, which is the system of global race, white supremacy. So I would argue that postmodernism is a refinement of the system of racism, white supremacy. And so anyone who appealed, particularly if they're a white person, anyone who appealed to postmodernism in order to develop a so-called neutral framework could be practicing a version of racism, white supremacy. And, you know, that's essentially what I argued in the blog. So that was one thing. The other thing I tried to point out was that, you know, who is this book really being written for? And what was the purpose of the book? And, you know, the whole slant of the book is to associate whiteness or white supremacy, xenophobia, and the idea that, you know, white people are technophobic of machines. They're also technophobic of non-white machines, i.e. black people, red people, brown people, yellow people, all non-white people. And hence, non-white people and machines are actually synonymous, and white people are technophobic in relation to them. So the kind of anxiety aspect, a fear aspect. And I'm not questioning in the blog piece, I endorse that and say, yeah, that I certainly, everything I've read in the over the past, say, 5 years, a more, hopefully more conscientious anti-racist analyst, everything has led me to endorse the view that there is a sense of alienation and distance and distanciation and phobia, anxiety, fear associated with white supremacy. But simultaneously, there's also a technophilia, a love and an embrace of the technological in white supremacy. And I think that's rampant. Now, you know, there are others to the paradox of whiteness, that just as where it asserts itself publicly, overtly, as supremacy, there is also a flood of what they call white crisis literature. And I mean, historically, this happened around the 20s, the last century, around 90s, just at the height of white supremacy, when overtly European, Caucasoid, however you want to classify them, or rather how they themselves would like to confuse us by classifying themselves. And there was, you know, an overt appeal to the language and symbolism of white supremacy. I mean, if you check the literature, Western or European or democratic or you know, just or civilized or culture, any other term, it was about whiteness explicitly. But simultaneous with that, you had the publication of books like Spengler's The Decline of the West. You had Lothrop Stoddard's classic work, Side of Color Against White World Supremacy, which is available online at the Bandung 2 website, which is www.bandung2.co.uk. If you look in the book section, you can pull down a copy of that. We have a whole lot of other books on there, which I welcome your listeners to go and access, obtain copies of, and distribute. I mean, we have a very clear position on copyright on that site. Sorry for the aside, point of clarification, that we see copyright as another control mechanism of the English power system. And, in order for us to be constructive, we need to disseminate information from both white people and non-white people as far as possible. And if that's violating a violation of information sharing, i.e. a violation of copyright equals copyright, then so be it. But that's an aside. But, you know, being broadcast in the public domain when there are appeals to the white race as the civilized race, as the master race, etc. Simultaneously, you had the publication of books like The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy and The Decline of the West. Now, how do we reconcile what Alistair Bonnett in his book, The Idea of the West, Chapter 1, has described as the paradox of white crisis at a time of the assertion of white supremacy? Well, I would argue that if you use Neely Fuller's code book, his very clear analysis, which is essentially system theory, the whole book is predicated on system theory, if you look at it carefully, that there are four stages of any system, and they are as follows. You have the establishment, you have its maintenance, you have the refinement or adaptation, and you have its expansion. And I would argue that the whole notion of technophobia in Kevorkian's analysis and white in the literature of the 20s, and as pointed to by Bonnett in his book The Idea of the West, that is simultaneous with the assertion of technophilia, or the love and embrace of technology, and also overt and explicit displays of white supremacy. Reason that you both need to a sense of anxiety and fear in order to keep the members of your race on heightened alert. They continue to adapt and or refine in order to retain the system of power relations. So you can't have one without the other. Like they say, is the glass half empty or half full? It's both. A coin has two sides. Similarly with the way that white supremacy functions, it functions both technophobically and technophilically, i.e. there's crisis and opportunity at the same time, because any system that perceives itself under threat will adapt itself in order to itself. It's simple survival. Apologies for the length of this presentation.
Outstanding. Please, if you could, I want you to share the information, because I found your blog, both of your sites, actually, very constructive. If you please share both of the web addresses for your sites with our listeners one more time, please, sir, Dr. Ali.
Sure, thank you. Well, the website of the Bandung Tu movement is www.bandung.co.uk, and the Bandung Tu blog, which is essentially a blog which I run, is http://bandung2.blog.co.uk.
Outstanding. Again, I want to emphasize with our listeners, just making an effort to connect with as many non-whites, victims of white supremacy as possible. I just found Dr. Ali's blog, just searching different blogs that deal with white supremacy, and I saw he had read Mr. Fuller's work, and just, you know, shot him an email telling him about my site and radio broadcast and asked if he would link the programs. He said, sure. I linked his programs, and I just, you know, kind of followed his blog and saw different things that he was writing about, and that's how I became informed about Dr. Kevorkian's work, and invited him to come on the show. He was here last week with just technical difficulties. I wasn't able to get him on the air, but yeah, he was gracious enough to come back again this week and share his views. And he's, again, all the way the area of the world known as London. Constructive work. More non-white people making an effort to do this. I think it would be very constructive in terms of sharing information and, you know, just to be able to have two non-white people from this distance talking about racism and white supremacy and sharing information. I think that's definitely constructive. So I'm super appreciative for Dr. Ali coming in and sharing his views 2 weeks in a row now, coming in and checking out the show. And I will continue to tell people to check out your site. Lots of constructive information. Yeah, hopefully I'll let you know when we have upcoming shows so you can come back and share your views with guests that we have in the future, sir.
I appreciate the offer, Gus. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank everybody again for tuning in to today's broadcast, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy. Please check out the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Also, subscribe to The Cows. That way you'll get all the updates for when we're going to have new shows, who the guests will be. You'll know as soon as the shows are created and posted online. Again, I want to thank Victim of White Supremacy, Susie Hu. Phenomenal job allowing me to use the phone. Save the day. Only reason I was able to do the show in the first place. Non-white person. Stars for Susie Hu all the way around. Woohoo! And to be an alumnus, University of Washington. Yay. Thanks all the non-white people again. Thank you Back in the Bus for assisting with last week's show and constructive information. Check out his blog, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. I want to thank all of the listeners who tuned into the show today. Please share it with your friends, download the program, tell folks about the show if you think it's constructive. Mr. Bradley, no solutions, but, you know, thank you. Calling in, participating in the broadcast. He's a white person, you know. What can you say? Akima, again, thank you for your assistance in getting the program off. Huge help today. Gold stars for Akima as well. Please check out her blog. Did you want to get a shout-out before the program ends?
No. Just a shout-out to my mother. Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Happy Mother's Day. Again, thank you to Akima for her assistance. DC, help me get Mr. Bradley's book, Non-White Team, Global Counter-Racist Effort. Right on. Non-white people getting our act together. And you heard it here. Mr. Bradley said, white people are not going to stop practicing racism, white supremacy, at least that's the view. I didn't think we could be incorrect, but you've got a white person and a non-white person saying that, you know, the evidence would seem to suggest white people are not going to stop doing this. If the problem of racism, white supremacy is going to be solved, it looks like it's going to be up to non-white people to change our behavior. Hopefully we're all making an effort to do that on a daily basis. And everything, in my view, should be evaluated, scrutinized. Is this constructive, replacing white supremacy with justice, or is this simply me perpetuating the system of racism, white supremacy. Everything should be up to scrutiny. We should all be making a constant effort to change our behavior. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out next show coming soon. It'll be posted. Thanks, everybody, for calling in. Gus T. Renegade, Context of White Supremacy. Thank you all for listening, and we will be back soon to hopefully replace the system of racism, white supremacy with a system of justice.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.